embarrassing songs.
Mm-hmm.
Like not necessarily guilty pleasures. I guess it would be that. I'm tired of that notion of guilty pleasures. But
because it's so subjective. Music is so subjective.
Well, who feels a guilty pleasure? It's kind of like a thing you do with knitting and candy or something like that. You're overeating candy. But like with music, I was thinking about there are some songs like from the 80s, Send Me an Angel by Real Love, Real Life, I mean,
yeah,
and Tainted Love, which to me, they're
the soft sell song.
Yeah, they should be like the front and back sides of a 45, even though it's a different band. They come out of the same weird place.
It works. And I think the definition of something like that would be if you are listening to it and you get it on pretty loud and you pull up to a stop sign or a stoplight, if you feel the need like instinctively and you can't overthink it, if you just feel like immediately you turn it down,
yeah,
then to me, you know what I mean?
Right. So you're controlling how the world
perceives you at that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No one is going to find out that I'm listening to Tainted Love.
Right. If somebody else was in the car with you, would you listen to it?
If Sam was. I mean, when you have a kid, you can get away with a
lot.
You
can, yeah. That's true.
But, you know, like, if I was listening to something like that and I pulled into someplace, I would even think about how much sound was getting through the window.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, is the boom, boom, getting through the window of my Tainted Love, because I would have to turn that down a little bit.
Like the bass line.
Yeah.
Would be tipping people off in the parking lot.
Yeah, and I don't
know.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel I've got to turn it down. I've got to roll up the windows, not let anyone know. I like this song so much, it's called Tainted Love. No one will ever find out that I like this song so much. I take the windows and I roll them up. Tainted Love, oh, Tainted Love. And it's, you know, it's not that I feel like I'm not proud that I like Tainted Love. It's more like I just don't want to deal with anybody who doesn't like it or who wants to judge me for it.
Well, maybe that's their problem then. It's not really yours at that point.
It is their problem, but I just don't want to deal with it. I don't want to. I don't want the dirty looks that you get for liking Tainted Love. You never experience any of these things.
It's true. Years ago, I was in the car with a friend. I don't know where we were going, but he was flipping the radio around. I think I was driving, and I was like, no, not that again. Oh, not that again. And it came up on a radio station, and it was playing, I think it was might have been a Hall & Oates song. And it might have been a Hall & Oates song. And I like Hall & Oates a lot, and I have no problem with saying that. I think Hall & Oates is great. And so he, you know, we stopped and like,
I'm judging you by
a little
way.
Bit. That's okay. It's all right.
You see me looking at you?
I feel comfortable maybe because we're in this room, this studio.
What's your favorite Hall & Oates?
My favorite Hall & Oates song. Boy, that's tough.
I know. There's so many good ones.
Yeah, that's really tough. I'll probably go with, I can't go for that.
No. No.
No.
No can do.
No can do. And it's, by the way, that's the title. I can't go for that, parentheses.
No.
No.
No can do. Is it really?
Yeah, it is.
I wonder why felt like they had to go right to the end of it. Yeah. That. Anyway, so you're...
Well, I think it was Hall & Oates. It might have been that, or it might have been a Journey song or something that we wouldn't normally like listen to. And for a minute, we looked at each other and was like, we had been through like 10 radio stations of just, we're going to have to spend an hour in the car and there's nothing on. And then we both looked at each other, and both of us had this like stupid grin. Yeah, we're going to listen to this. And he just turned it up a little bit, and we just looked straight ahead, and we've never spoken of it since. We both were in agreement. We like this song. We're not going to speak of it. That's all. We're just going to enjoy the next 3.5 minutes. We enjoyed it very loudly, and that was the end of it.
It's
and we've never spoken of it since.
It's very beautiful and touching, but it's also a little gross. I don't know, to think about these two men not talking about something, that they're sharing this moment.
Well, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like we killed the guy and had him in the trunk and never spoke of it. It was just a song on the radio.
But you did you say that it was that song?
I think it was Hall & Oates, but I can't remember offhand. It was a particular song that, you know, the hipster community would definitely lambaste me for.
Right.
And
there are lots of bands, poppy bands from the '80s. We were talking about Duran Duran earlier,
yeah.
Who had a kind of a second coming in a sort of way. Like when Duran Duran first came out, they were so popular, it was easy to just throw them off into
the
ocean.
Girl, yeah. Boy band kind
just
of thing.
Put them in the place that maybe people might put Justin Bieber today.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of like there's an element of just grotesque poppery about it. But then shortly, I mean, then they put out all their albums. They kind of faded a bit, and there seemed to be some kind of rethink about them, a critical rethink about Duran Duran, and they were sort of raised up as these kind of artistic pop stars, and they had this little second life and
post new wave kind of art band.
Yeah, but at the time it was kind of like they were like New Kids on the Block.
Yep, exactly.
In the way that New Kids on the Block stayed New Kids on the Block and kind of continued down the hill of like young pop, you know, thing from long ago that we don't mind forgetting. But Duran Duran had this, like, it was almost like as though there were articles written about New Yorker, like, we're rethinking Duran Duran, you know? Like, they're doing things like Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. Like, people were thinking about them in this way, like, that they had this musical skill or this talent that we hadn't been able to perceive when all these hits were flying at us.
But with perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look
I
at
think
this.
If you look at a band like a Duran Duran or even a Hall & Oates or something like that, I think Hall & Oates probably had some more, you know, weight to them because they had a longer career and there were, you know, lots of hits. But I think it was a wider appeal. But you look at Duran Duran, it was an actual band. They were people. They did write their own songs. They did, you know, of course they were very slickly produced. It was high in production. But I saw, this is a while back, but I saw some kind of documentary on bands at that time, and they were interviewing Duran Duran. They had a couple of the members of the band, and they were saying something like, we know we had that image after a couple of years, but when we did our first album, and then we had a couple of minor hits with that, and then we did that Rio album that had Hungry Like the Wolf and all of that, mm-hmm. and it blew up worldwide, and we suddenly got that perception as being this kind of boy band. And because of all the clothes and everything, they said, well, we did all the clothes and the make. It was kind of a precursor to the hair bands of later in the decade, because we were trying to make videos and trying to sell records. And this is what you had to do, apparently, to do it. We really were a serious band. We had been together for years. We were trying to make music together. And I don't think, like, the boy bands of the 90s really, I mean, that wasn't true. They were all put together by, you know, a conglomerate. To sing pre-recorded songs. Yeah, wasn't there one?
There was one guy from...
What's his name? And he used to produce like 10 boy bands or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, the songs were all penned by writers. You know, they didn't play any instruments. They sang, and that was it. I mean,
it was like Milli Vanilli.
Yeah, but it was all manufactured pop.
Yeah.
Where at least over Duran Duran or some of those new wave bands, yeah, the production value was high, but it was... They were actual bands behind it. They were actually writing and producing songs
right.
themselves. So, I mean, there's some kind of artistic credibility that a Duran Duran would have that I would argue New Kids didn't have.
Right. Well, I think the New Kids, I feel like the New Kids, I can't make any, I don't have a good historical grasp of the New Kids on the Block. I was going to make a couple points about it, but I don't know if we need to spend too much
time on that.
Well, you know what? Speaking of the sort of... embarrassing music and things like that. I mean, you were a rock DJ for a while,
yeah.
long while. And I know that there were a lot of songs you have to play that probably just bothered you. But were there?
No.
No?
I loved every single one of them.
Well, you know, sort of like, I think you mentioned before that Nickelback might have been.
Playing Nickelback every 24 hours in my life was exactly what I wanted to do. It was the artistic statement I wanted to make.
But were there songs like that you were embarrassed that you liked? That you were playing, that, you know, sort of like everybody knows that Nickelback is gross,
mm-hmm.
But there was a couple of them that you really liked. You know, did you have any things like that where it was?
Yeah, I suppose there must have been over the years. Sure, yeah. I mean, there's songs too that I probably liked at the time that I would hear now and say, oh, what did I see in that?
Yeah.
But I think it's true for everybody. I don't know if that's just. I think there were songs that that I just genuinely got so burnt out on because you would play them again and again and again, and you'd have to, that it took me years to go back. Like, I couldn't listen to any Led Zeppelin for probably a decade, literally. I just the minute I would hear anything from Led Zeppelin or, you know, some classic rock band that, you know, like The Who or something, you know, all good music, all, you know, incredible stuff, but it was just, come on. The last thing I want to hear in my life is, you know, Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin.
Hey, mama said the way you move.
Very nice. Yeah. And now.
That's my sock puppet.
And now, you know, it's just in the last couple of years that I've actually gone back and started being able to listen to some of that stuff. And I still won't listen to, like, the really overly played stuff. But some of the deeper. And because it's like, well, oh, yeah. I remember why I loved this as a teenager.
It's like you were traumatized.
Well, yeah, you get bludgeoned to death, you know.
By Black Dog.
You worry about seeing an axe. You know, if you get hit enough times, you kind of get weary of it. So, but, like when the levee breaks.
Oh, I love
that song. It's a great song. The drums in that song are just phenomenal.
It keeps on raining.
It just, yeah, it's so good. But, you know, there was a good decade where if I heard that, I would want to throw up. Not again.
You know, every song that has the levee in it,
yeah,
that levee is a huge hit. You know, Don McLean, the Down by the Levee.
Yeah.
When the levee breaks. I mean, I've written like 10 levee songs. None of them is really working for me. But I don't know why people don't rely more on the levee.
It's a great metaphor.
For a lyrical thing, bring it in. Bring the levee back. If I was a professional songwriter, I would go into the meeting where they're talking about, like, what are we going to write about for lyrics? I'd be like, look, we're going to do the levee, okay? This is a song for Taylor Swift. She's going down to the levee.
I think Taylor Swift would be a perfect fit for a song about levees.
Exactly.
Any metaphor with levee would work in a country-type song.
Yeah, like she's... I have the impression that she writes her own music.
I think she does write some of it.
I like. That's sort of...
Can respect that.
And Adele. Adele also writes her own music.
I'm a big fan of Adele.
I like her too.
I think she's incredible.
Yeah, she's, you know what, she's like, despite all things. I mean, you could, I sort of feel like she's a despite all odds person. Mm-hmm. Maybe because she's not classically, she doesn't look like any of the other pop stars of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a little freer with, you know, her being, you know, the way she talks, the way she is. She acts kind of casual, like a person on the street.
Right.
But then her voice is so, you know, convincing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that she writes her own music, I mean, I wonder, like, the people, like all the other pop stars out there that don't write their own music, you know, that are kind of in that machine,
mm-hmm.
what do they think about Taylor Swift and Adele? Are they sort of, like, resentful? Or I wonder if they...
They're jealous of the talent, probably.
I would think.
Are they that self-aware?
I would think they'd have to be somewhere, but I
don't know. I wonder how self-aware you can get at that level.
I always felt like it wasn't even proper to be like it's almost like you, in order to be a big pop star, you have to write your own songs. Like in my sort of naive sensibility, that's how I feel like it should be.
I don't think it's ever been that way though.
I know, like Frank Sinatra never wrote one song.
Yeah,
you're like, but how can he not write a song? He could just start singing and it would be there. It's like. In a lot of ways, when I'm doing music, it's the sound of the piano or whatever it is that I'm playing that makes the music come alive. Or even like if I'm singing, sometimes I'll be singing. It's the sound of the voice sort of accidentally, and you witness it. And I always wonder, the people with beautiful voices, why they can't write songs.
I wanted to ask you about your Valentine's song that you posted this past week. And... How did that, let's use that as an example. Where did that come from? Because the lyrics are, like a lot of your lyrics, it's almost this kind of, you know, obtuse kind of.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a direct narrative.
Well, here,
so it's like, how does that come about? Like, where did that start? Did that start with you at the keys, or did that start with you with just a little melody in your head, a little up and down phrase?
It started with at the beginning of the song, you'll hear a little bit of nonsense stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I go like this, ba-da-da-da-da,
right?
Like that. That whole song started off with. I just wanted to do something nonsensical where, like one of those songs that just used like a Bobby McFerrin thing, So the original movement and sound of that song was me with doing all these different voices. So like, and then chanting along to a certain thing like, bum, 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 bum. And then another voice coming in going, ba-do-do-do, ba-do-do-do, ba-do. So I just want to do this overlay of different voices and sounds.
It almost starts off like a, almost Kate Bush-ish. It has this kind of...
There's a little weird organ
kind of
going around.
Yeah, it is very, and then to me, I love how you have that little kind of almost like a nursery rhyme feel to it, and then there's this kind of, I don't know, syncopated rhythm, and then all of a sudden the lyrics come in, and it just, it takes you through three or four different stages all within 3 minutes.
That's something that has been probably, like, because I don't know music well, and I don't play very well, and I don't understand composition except from what I sort of discover along the way. You know, there's a change in that song where it kind of dissolves and goes into a sort of a boom, boom, boom part. Like, that for me is, I can see that I've moved along from my old style of songwriting. Because in my old days, I would just do that one part, you know, and I might repeat it two or three times, maybe without new lyrics even, because I'd be just like, I can't think of any.
Have a bridge? You wouldn't have any kind of...
Well, I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Or I would look for it and I couldn't find it. A lot of my musical things are struggles. So a lot of this, like, I'll come up with a lot of songs in my head, like walking around. If I'm out walking around, I'll start singing. And I'll sing something, and I'll sometimes record it on my phone, but I can never find the music to play with it. Like, I can't figure out what the notes are supposed to be, and then it just kind of burns away into nothing because I can't. But these songs that I love, you know, I'm like, oh, this would be such a beautiful song, but I don't know how to do anything with it.
Did you set that aside? Do you hold on to that recording, or do you just say,
music
does that fade off to nothing?
Music is one of those things, I think, that you can be really, really, I'm sort of prolific, I mm-hmm. guess, because I just like to do it. It doesn't mean that it's good. It just means that there's a lot of content generated, over the course of the week. You know, I could just sit down and write three little bits of a song. Again, it's not like, it's rare that something's really, really good. You know, it's like you have your whole range. And what is really, really good that I call really good, I don't know what that means in terms of the world. You know, it doesn't mean I can win a song contest or that more anybody else is going to like it. It just means that to me, I'm like, oh, that's, I think I'm always the songs where I'm like, oh, I can't even believe that I did that. That's where I feel like that cool connection to like creation. It's almost like when I no longer can believe that I made something, that's when I both appreciate my experience, separate from my experience, and feel good about it. Like when I no longer actually mm-hmm. think I did it, I'm most like, yeah, that's great. It's a weird thing because you'd think like you become more and more vested and connected to it and think more and more that that was you. But the most successful things for me, from the way I think about them, are the things that I feel least... Like, I can't really claim anything about it. I'm like, wow, that was lucky.
Attention, senses. senses. Tension senses. Snow, if snow you know is blind. Attention senses. Attention senses. Attention senses. Attention senses.
Mentioned something about the lyrics and the so that song wasn't a Valentine's Day song originally. It was only after the fact when I sort of was thinking about it. I thought of it as kind of a strange love thing, or but I didn't know what it was referring to. But I remember seeing or listening to an interview with I think the main lyricist for Def Leppard, and how he was saying, you know, how he writes his lyrics. It's just whatever it sounds like. You know, so he'll sing along to whatever he's doing, like, and just do the la-la stuff. He'll just go, and then it, whatever words work with those sounds best is yeah, what it, is what this, and I do that a lot.
It's so, attitude.
So with that song, you know, when I first was singing, I was like, just, and it's like, be oh my entire, those were just sounds, and then I just fit those words to them, and then a lot of the other stuff was just improvised, you know, like long before the sun, like the whole, that was just improvised at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I also like, I like the naturalness of it. Like, I don't know if it comes out with, it comes up with good a good lyric, but I like the unconscious attachment that something is, a story is being told by the unconscious, uncontrolled. It's not something that I'm editing too much. And I also like, it's similar with poetry. You know, I think people like poetry or like to write poems, especially rhyming poems, because they're locked into a type of form. They have to rhyme it. So with that limitation, there's this, you're a little free because you know you're being controlled. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing.
There's some structure. Yeah. It's hard to make a painting if you don't know where the edge of the paper is. And if you have some kind of control, some kind of boundary, that almost frees you up to create. I know it sounds
I think it works
counterintuitive,
like that.
But I think it does work like that. I think there has to be some kind of frame of reference that you can fill in.
Right.
You
know? But then, so I for me, like, lyrics are a very I have an many different, like, there are some lyrics that I will work on because it feels like it's worth it, or it feels like this is a story that can be told. But then there are other ones that just, songs that just feel kind of impressionistic. And so they can have this kind of loose application where, you know, at the end of it, you could be like, it's kind of a love story, but I couldn't point out who the main characters are or what they're doing.
But in the end, that's, I think, what, for me, and lyrics or writing, I guess any art. I mean, like you said, impressionistic. You could talk about impressionistic painters. It's about a feeling. It's about, or an attitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, even you're talking about Def Leppard. It's not necessarily about that specific lyric.
Right.
You know, like it's you know, rock is an attitude. A painting, impressionistic painting, is about giving you a mood, giving you a feeling. And you impress your feelings on it.
Right.
And songs can do that too. The greatest music, I think, is music that's not explained.
Hmm.
That's why I'm not a big fan of, like, liner notes or even lyrics.
Hmm.
I you know, printed on well,
really, you didn't like lyrics?
You know, I did when I was kind of obsessing over music when I was younger, But now that I think about it, the older I get, the less I want to know the backstory. I almost don't want to know all the. I don't want to know what you were thinking when you were writing this or that, because to me, and I love when lyric writers or authors refuse to answer specific questions. Who is this about? Is this about your ex-wife? And they say, I don't know. It could be. Could be about my dog. Could be about a frog. It doesn't matter. It's just, what is it to you? You know, what does it mean to you? And that's, to me, that's what great art does. It's what it means to me.
Hold it
in
now.
My life.
So you set me up. You asked me this song about my song, and then I go along and I don't do that cool thing. I should have just said,
no, I didn't
hey, Rick,
mean to. I didn't, no.
This, you're going to have to tell me what you think
No,
of
no,
it,
no. I asked you about your process.
It was a big setup.
I asked about your process. I didn't ask if it was about your wife. I didn't ask if it was,
I was going. You knew I'd go to Def Leppard and explanations like that.
I did not know. No, the Def Leppard came out of left field.
Well, that's,
I mean, honestly, why wouldn't, when you're talking about great lyric writing, why wouldn't you talk about a guy who wrote, you've got the peaches, I've got the cream? Seriously. Is there any greater lyric?
What about Eben Gleben Globin Globin?
Yeah.
You can't beat that. That was one where I guess he just couldn't figure out words for it. He just like, let's Eben just keep it Eben Gleben Globin Globin.
I like that, though. Yep.
All right. You know, another person,
so,
like...
Be honest, you turn that up, but then you turn it down at the stoplight, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Def Leppard, that would definitely be something.
I will turn
no
up the
one...
Def Leppard once in a while if I hear that. I will do that. Not every time, but every once in a while. If it hits you just the right mood.
They were
the sun
cool.
is shining, it's warm out.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Speaking of rock, this, you know what... I mentioned that I listen to Gene Shepherd a lot.
Yeah.
He does that whole, that whole traditional segue thing, speaking of, so that he can move on to the next thing. And I realized that I don't have that tool. Like, I don't have that transition tool where I'm like, we could talk about something and I know we want to move on to something else.
But that's the beauty of this, of what we're doing here. There's no transition. This is a conversation.
But let's.
I know we're contradicting ourselves about having boundaries and all that. But the boundary to me, the frame of reference for us, is simply it's a couple of guys talking.
Friendly gentlemen.
Friendly gentlemen.
Both from the earth.
Just lighting the lamps.
Right.
This is all this is, and that beyond that, it's whatever we want it to be.
It's a human being show.
Yeah. Well, imagine like you were talking earlier before we started taping. You go taping. There's another age related issue there.
I like that's a better word for it than anything else.
Yeah, there's not a piece of magnetic tape in this building. It's just nothing but hard drives. But
who wants to record on a hard drive? I like the idea of this tape spooling
spinning
and spooling
reels.
In dark rooms.
Speaking of which, I wanted to tell you this is one thing I remember I wanted to bring up, and this relates back to music and tape. There was a documentary that was released earlier this month called Sound City. Dave Grohl.
I saw that you posted about it. Yes.
Absolutely fantastic. And even if you're not like a rockumentary sort of person, like you don't care about music documentaries, you should see this one because it's really well done. It's got a million people in it from rocks from you know, the mid-70s till today. And Dave Grohl, he was meticulous in finding people that recorded in this. It's very famous Rat Hole studio. I mean, Fleetwood Mac's Rumours was recorded in it. I think the band did some work there. Neil Young did some work there. And then into the 80s, you know, a lot of the hair bands were there. Nirvana did Nevermind there.
Wow.
Rage Against the Machine did a lot of their stuff there. It just, and he talks about the beauty of recording to tape through this big analog board. And I'm not going to get too, I know people don't want to get too technical about it, but there's, you know, these consoles, the Neve consoles, which were, you know, like the end all be all for audio files. And he bought the board after the studio went bankrupt. And the documentary begins with him doing that. He buys the board, but he brings everybody who is recorded in this. He goes through the first hour of the documentary is the whole history of Sound City. And then the last 45 minutes or so is him doing jam sessions with people right up to Paul McCartney.
Wow.
And
using that board?
Using like that board in his studio, in his personal studio.
Oh, I think that's why I heard that weird Dave Grohl, Paul McCartney song.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
I think
okay.
It's a soundtrack that they're doing for it.
Yeah.
But and actually, that collaboration, when I heard that was going to happen, I'm like, oh, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, it seems goofy.
And it was really good.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. And I think that some of the the movie is just really well done. But they talk about tape and the fact that the studio was all tape-based. Yeah. And as, you know, the 90s went on, and of course people were just forgetting about tape and everything was going to computer, you know, they kind of just, they'd ignored it. And of course that was their downfall. But the fact that, you know, and they were showing people like engineers taking the tape out and cutting it and splicing it, like I used to do in the beginning of my radio career and all of that. And they would show other people and I'm like, this is just completely foreign to me.
Right.
It's just, I don't, why would anybody do this archaic thing?
I love how close that, like, we don't often think of how close film and sound, music, mm-hmm. anything like that are, but when you see them splicing the tape together, you kind of see that this, that the sound world is just sort of like the film world, but for the mm-hmm. for the ear.
True.
And I always love the idea, but I don't connect those at all. I mean, I think of them as separate things, almost like I would say the film is close to audio as audio is close to dinner. You know, they seem like different animals, but really they're very, very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are, and it's and there is I think that this push that like theaters are doing now, where they're doing digital projection.
Mm.
I don't think, at least the ones that I've seen, aren't quite as good as the 35mm film.
Hmm.
Although the 35mm film theaters, a lot of them weren't, you know, they had very dim bulbs or terrible screens or bad sound or something. So they didn't keep them up. But I still think the best 35mm stock looks better than some of the digital projection stuff they've got. I don't think it's quite there yet.
I've read articles about, like, great, you know, that you can go to certain movie theaters and get an incredibly, you know, the perfect... Mm-hmm. cinematic experience, like they use, like, but that a
but
lot of
not
movie
the
theaters
suburban
are
suburban theater, you know.
Well, I heard that there's different ways that these guys are cheating. Like the bulbs for these, the projectors are really expensive, and they need three bulbs. And a lot of the film guys will just use two because it's enough. And so I think Roger Ebert did this thing on the state of movie theaters in the country, and where they went around and like there were none of the theaters were showing the films the way they were supposed to be, mm-hmm. like with. With the right projector,
the right
with the
luminance,
right settings, the different, like, they were all kind of cheating it a little bit. And so it's weird. I don't know if I've ever
seen a proper film.
Yeah, I feel like I've always gone to, like, some crummy theater, you know, where it was slightly missing the screen and, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like they're, but do these modern theaters, like, we've gone to that one down in Hooksett.
Yeah.
We saw Avatar.
It was
right?
One of those. Yeah, it was a 3D screen and all that, right?
Yeah, was that like is that amazing?
See, I didn't find it to be a very good experience. But again, I thought the movie was crap. Yeah, I thought Avatar was awful. But that's me.
I didn't think it was awful. But I was just so happy to be there with you that it made it much better.
Oh,
much better.
Oh.
That was the.
Yeah, are we having a moment?
It's like two guys driving down the road listening to Hall & Oates.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I think that
It was
so heavy-handed.
And it's a goofy film.
It was, yeah. It was so overwrought, I think would be the phrase I would use.
But, you know, I kind of stowed all that and just
spectacle.
Well, I have trouble with the whole CGI look to me, that whole rubbery being. Everybody kind of looks rubbery and strange, mm-hmm. like when they're CGI. I just am constantly bothered by it. It just doesn't look right to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get it, and I appreciate it, and there's beautiful colors and stuff like that. But, you know, even with, like, The Hobbit, the latest, which is, I think, probably the most advanced CGI.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
And so Gollum, I mean, people made a big deal out of how realistic Gollum looks. You know, he's almost lifelike. And he is almost lifelike, but he's not.
He's not, yeah.
He's still, I'm constantly, I never can think, I'm always thinking this is a piece of plastic. This is a moving, like, look how well they've created Gollum. I'm constantly thinking, wow, they really did a good job mm-hmm. with Gollum and that. Constantly, like, as he turns
it's
his
like
eyes.
It's like a movie with Tom
stuff.
Cruise and people like, you know, Tom Cruise was really good in this movie. But yeah. You never stop thinking, oh, there's Tom Cruise.
Right. You know
it's
what would be awesome
same.
Is, let's say Tom Cruise gets to be 53, and he starts to teeter into
age.
He's
got to be close to that anyway, doesn't he?
He's probably, yeah. So maybe,
50,
okay,
right?
Let's say he gets to be older than that. He's 58 uh-huh. or 59. And he decides he's going to start his career over. He's going to do these movies where he becomes a CGI version of himself. So they just do, they go back and he's like 20 years old again. So he just starts, he keeps doing, he does the voice, you know, as Tom Cruise. But he has the second career as an animated character. But it's so realistic, you can't tell. I could see him having a whole, like he could go from 50 to 80 years old, still being 30-year-old Tom Cruise. And you can, because at that point, we're going to be so good at this stuff, at this, or maybe we just won't care that things still look kind of rubbery and odd. Why not?
You know what? He'd be the guy to do it. He'd be the star that they'd hang that on.
He starts over.
Yeah.
He can start over digitally. I think he could be the pioneer.
Nowadays start over digitally?
I wish.
Our online selves. Can't we all be different? Can't we all live cyber lives outside of ourselves?
I feel like everybody has the same kind of like misgivings about the dumb internet and Facebook, and everybody's like,
everybody on Facebook is having a great life. Have you noticed that? Everybody's having a fantastic life. Everybody's family is perfect. Everybody has a great dog. Everybody's driving fantastic cars. They're all having fantastic vacations.
It is very statusy. It's a status update in the truest sense of the word.
Look how wonderful my marriage is. Look at my kids. They're all great. Look at how proud I am of all of them.
Look at you. Look at, you should post something about that right now about how grumpy you are.
And another thing. No, but conversely, do you have some friends on Facebook who are just the absolutely everything is wrong? Oh my God, my cereal. I didn't have any milk for my cereal. It's all going to hell today. And right from like 6 o'clock in the morning, they're posting how awful. Oh, work is so frustrating. If I only had a hammer, I'd beat everybody in the head.
It's either they're going to commit suicide or things just couldn't be more right. It's just really working out for them.
It's all working out for me. Every work success they have to post.
I think that's why I don't post, because I'm neither that unhappy or that things aren't. It's in the middle somewhere where I'm like, I'm just working. I got to do a little work here.
Have we not learned what Facebook and Twitter are for? They are for snide, sarcastic commenting. That is what they are for.
That's a good. I mean, a lot of people. You know, there are people that are so good at Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about it as a phenomenon of people who are like can really encapsulate. They're funny in this Twittery way. There's like a Twitter sense of humor, like the way that they use this.
What is it? What's that elusive?
I don't know,
thing?
But I can't do it. But I'm curious about them. I'm like, does this translate into, like, are these people really great writers? Are they? Do they work for television shows? What, or are they just at home unemployed?
I think they're all
but
just
they're so
unemployed
good at
copywriters.
That could, but it just seems like there's this world of really talented quipsters.
I would think a comedian would be like a number one.
Wouldn't it be perfect for a comedian?
It's a comedian. It's all one-liners.
I would hate Twitter if I was a comedian, because it's like. And there's a lot of
it's taking your audience.
Well, it's just so like I got to do Twitter. I got to come up with some one-liners. I don't know. It just seems like it's so not there. I think
cheapening the art.
It's not. There's nothing there anymore. I don't know. There's increasingly nothing there to me with Twitter. It's just
in
like,
a world where
there.
Everybody can do everything.
In a world
we have in a world where everyone can do everything. We have nothing.
Tweety.
It's very existential.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. I watch Netflix on my TV. We have it through a game console.
We have that.
And that fact, that's what we use the Wii for 90% of the time.
I know.
And the other 10% is bowling.
That's about
I can't get. I love the bowling. My daughter has like other games.
I like ping pong.
The ping pong's pretty fun.
Yeah,
it's pretty fun. Yeah,
but there is a kind of as awesome as the controller is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little fudgy, like especially with the ping pong. It has to. It's not as reactive. You need it to be a little finer. Otherwise, it's you know.
You could just wave it in the air and get the same thing.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd like to be. I think the thing is that I would love it if being really good at ping pong on Wii meant that you were actually really good at ping pong.
I agree.
Like, you could actually get good. You don't need
a table. So I feel
about
the bowling. I've gone bowling, and I can't get anywhere near what I get on the Wii. The Wii, I can. I get finesse. I have control. And I don't feel like I get that.
I feel like that would be like that would be really great if they could figure out that get closer and closer to translating the skill, so that actually you are getting, you would become a better bowler.
Well, don't they do that with they do like in airline pilots have to train on simulators, don't they?
They do. Yeah.
I really hope they're better than what we're getting at home, because I don't want them learning and thinking they're getting better in the simulator and then getting the real thing. Because if that's true, my daughter loves playing. That there's a
this is scary.
There's a plane simulator thing on Wii.
Oh yeah,
on the, you know, the sports thing is that you go around Wii Island and you collect little medallions or something.
That was taken directly from the TWA. Flight training.
Was it? Yeah. Was it right?
That's
here?
What they
That's
use.
Exactly what it's from.
Yeah.
And it's a fun thing, but I'm quite sure that that is not translating to getting your private pilot's license. I'm pretty sure that she's not ready to go, even though she's collected every level there is of it.
Right.
So I'm wondering if the real flight simulators are a little more nuanced.
That's a good point.
I'd like an FAA investigation.
Right.
I'm saying it right here and now. I'd like some.
But do they actually? I mean, I feel like the space shuttle people use simulations, but do pilots? Because I don't know if going up in a plane, like, I don't think that they. It almost feels like they would do simulations for very specific things, like if you were going to bomb somebody, because you don't get to do that very often. But it seems like you can just hop in a plane with somebody who knows how.
I think they do some kind of training before they, or maybe in conjunction with, because I can't imagine they can get all the hours they want on, like, the Lear jets. It'd be too expensive to just fly empty jets in training. I think they do simulations as well as training on
On those the are job. Super expensive. Those are, like, crazy $10,000 a half hour to fly.
I would think,
whatever.
With all the fuel and and the staff you would need. But I think they probably, the co-pilots are probably in training, too, sometimes. They probably go along on commercial flights, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah.
You'd have to.
They're probably flying it for a little while. Some guy who can't fly.
It's all done by computer anyway, isn't it? Don't they just flip a switch and then they go off with a stewardess out back? I mean, isn't it?
That's why they have a door.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why not let us look up there?
Because there's nobody there.
Right.
Yeah. There's nobody there.
I would hate, I actually am scared of the cockpit. I don't want to see all that stuff.
Too many buttons and.
It's like a lot of stuff that can go wrong, you know?
I think that a lot of that is show. I think it's like a 30s sci-fi movie. It's all these meters and dials and switches. There's really only one lever that means. It's just that lever that goes, you know, the ramp up and ramp down. I think all of the other stuff is show. I think they want to make it look like, you know, this is very important equipment. And it turns out that really, no, it's just like an on-off shit. It's just like it's like a toggle switch, a little throttle.
Wouldn't it be awesome, though, if you ever did go up to the cockpit and the guy was just flying around, flicking buttons, turning dials, he's
flashing
sweating,
lights.
He's got to take his shirt off because he's doing so much stuff, he's lifting things that are hard to push, he's got to keep the wings up, I got to pump this thing to get the fuel out there. That would be so great if it was really, really physically.
he's the Great Oz. He's back there, he's pulling levers, he's moving. Yeah, right.
Oh, I see. That's better than just sitting up there and there's like a guy with one finger on a really heavy piece of metal keeping that plane going forward, and he's just half awake.
I think with the computer, with the GPS computers, that's really what's happening. I think once they get going, I think it's really all of that stuff is being controlled by software. And, you know, you think back to the days of like steam, when it took like guys like giant steam pistons and there's hot flowing water everywhere, and you know, I mean, to me, that's engineering. I think when you know you're piloting, you know, modern aircraft or even like a car nowadays, it's all done. It's all done for you. All you gotta do is hold one finger on the wheel and just do a little bit of turning, just a little, and you don't have to do anything anymore.
Would you get it on a plane if it was being driven by a computer? There was no one up there.
No, I would have to have somebody at least, obviously, with the hand on the till in case.
So, but you wouldn't mind if a flight was completely automated if there was somebody up there to take
over?
From what
I understand, it can be done. Like the computer can land a plane now. It can literally take off and land because of the radar it has on it, the GPS it has on it. It can, if a pilot became incapacitated, if they configure it, they push the right button.
They can autopilot.
It can autopilot in. Yeah.
See, I don't know. I don't like that. Like, oh, it's sort of like the same thing. Like, I'm sure very soon we'll be able, you know, there are computer robot guys that'll be able to do surgery. You know, robot doctor Bob, you know, can do your brain surgery. Probably better than, you know.
More precise than a human hand. Yeah. But what if at that moment it needs a reboot? You know what I mean? What if some you hear the dunk of the Windows, you know, error message.
Right.
Just as it's about to carve into your brain. Just as that needle's right in the middle there.
Yeah.
And it just, okay, well, you know, takes 10 minutes. We'll reboot it. Everything will be fine.
Well, I think that's just, you know, that all they can do is compare error rates. You know, these humans are going to make errors and doctors are going to make errors. So what is the rate of error?
True.
So if you make, if a human makes one, you know, a top pilot makes one mistake out of every 100, you know, maneuvers, if the computer is beating
one in a thousand.
That,
yeah.
Then I suppose statistically you're good. But I still don't like the principle. I don't like us not being in the driver's seat. I feel like that's what we've been in the driver's seat of our experience, of our culture, of our civilization for as long as we've been here. And now that seat, that driver's seat, is being taken over. There's a new king in town, and it's not us. And we are, I mean, I can almost see governance. Or financial, you know, like, do we need somebody who's at the top of the Fed, or do we need a computer at the top of the Fed? You know, no Alan Greenspan. We need Big Blue.
It's just analyzing data.
Well, why not?
It's just crunching numbers totally.
Making
it's
tiny
constant.
Little adjustments to our, you know, let's change the rate of this, we'll change the rate of that. It's much more flexibly and thoughtfully.
But what you run into there, though, I think the bigger problem isn't necessarily the machine taking over. It's some other human entity taking over that machine that's an enemy of ours.
Right.
In other words, you know, it's cyber terrorism or something.
Right.
And that's where the real problem comes in.
Wherever he would go, the old lamplighter of long, long ago, his snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow. The old lamplighter of long, long ago, you'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile had a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter wherever he long, long ago. Now if you look up in the sky, you'll understand the reason why the little stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here, he turns them off when dawn is near, the little man we loved of long ago. He made the night a little brighter wherever